This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3
102.1. And we're here with a couple of local filmmakers. And they're working on a film, but I'll let them explain it. The film is about what, Miles?
Yes, our guests today are Miles Curtis and Alex McDougall. Alex McDougall Weber.
Favorite. He's hyphenated. Yeah.
And you're working on a documentary on the Near East Side, right?
Yeah. Hey, this is Miles. We got started off working on a project that was specifically about Poindexter Village, and then kind of found out that there was other interest in just kind of a wider East Side documentary. So we've like literally been just going up and down the streets, videotaping the streets, talking to whoever will talk to us, going out and finding historians, looking up old maps and old newspapers.
Have you gotten to the King Lincoln people yet?
We just finished an interview with Willis Brown a minute ago. It came up a couple times today. It came up with another person as well. The names of neighborhoods and how it can be really arbitrary in general. A lot of times it's kind of marketing. That's been one really interesting discovery that we've kind of found, is how much like deliberate marketing goes on in neighborhoods. And it's, if you have like a car dealership, and the difference in your business between when you have advertisements coming out and saying, hey, this car dealership is amazing, and then, it almost seems like even if you have like a decent car dealership and you don't advertise it, you kind of look like crap just because, there's no one out there saying, whoa, be amazed. Even if you're decent, then no one's amazed. And then they're like, oh, this is kind of...
Happens with movies, too.
Yeah. Really gotta get out there and
advertising. So what are some of the neighborhoods in Columbus that have been marketed in different ways?
If you look at some of, like, the bit of just, like, the Near East Side, right? So let me say Near East Side. It even has one area commission, which is kind of weird because then you actually break down the neighborhood. There's Old Town East, which is a neighborhood that is fairly well marketed.
And we're probably in it right now.
Yeah, we're in it right now.
Because we're on the south side of Broad Street.
That's right.
Roger Dodger. And then, you look at that and you compare that to, like, a traditional Brownsville or, like, Mount Vernon today, a lot of the business there has been kind of built over, so then, and then people moved out, but you look at a neighborhood that really doesn't have any representation at all. That would be, an example of what we think of as, like, a neighborhood where, like, no one is just, thinking of it as a business so much as a place where people live, but then because there's no one really hyping it up, then there's not a lot of business in there at the moment, you have any amount of not good word, and then any amount of kind of negative imagery that might be there, whether it's perceived or whether it's based on reality, or even like a little bit of reality plus a little bit of perception, gives you this kind of big horrible stink. And then people are like, oh, the is it safe question, everywhere is pretty safe. We're in Columbus, Ohio. So, like, if you're in Ohio, you're safe. Like, you really don't have to worry.
So what, any big surprises since you've been working on the documentary? Have you learned something that you didn't expect?
Yeah, well, something very straightforward would be, we started the project under the impression that we were doing a movie project about one neighborhood, and fairly soon into our work, we discovered that we were dealing with not only several neighborhoods, but right here between Old Town East and the Mount Vernon corridor, we were dealing with one of the richest and one of the poorest neighborhoods in the entire city. Okay. About 50, 60 years ago and farther back as well. So that's been pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, and then, another question is, when in time are you in the neighborhood? Because depending on when you are, these neighborhoods go from being, really upscale, richy neighborhoods that black people were not allowed to be in at all, to entirely black neighborhoods, to, like, mixed immigrant communities, So depending on where you are and then, like, when in time you're talking about that specific plot of land, there's all sorts of things have happened. Like, a little bit of, like, I mean, literally kind of, like, one of each of everything has happened somewhere in, this relatively small area, so...
And again, Broad Street being the old Mansion Row for the white elite. And of course, the emergence of King Lincoln, which some of the older neighborhoods argue is not really a neighborhood. Did you come across any of the debate over whether or not Mount Vernon should be renamed?
We had one person mention that. It was one person off the street, so it wasn't even like a city person or anything like that. So hopefully it's just kind of a rumor, because we heard it in the context of a rumor. But yeah, when you start talking about, you know, like kind of like made up neighborhood names, we had a pretty interesting conversation about that earlier today. About, you know, like even like German Village or like Harrison West, like, you know, like who exactly is the Harrison that isn't there? You know, Poindexter Village is named after a guy, you know, James Poindexter, who left lots of institutions behind him. He left a massive church, you know, the first black schools in Columbus, which is really funny when we're looking that up on the website. And you look up the story of James Poindexter, it talks about, you know, how he, like, fought the city to get schools made for African-American kids, and then, you know, once the schools existed, he had to fight for the schools to be good, and he ended up having to even, like, join city council to kind of protect that interest, and then the school board, he ended up having to, like, you know, join these institutions to make sure that there even was a space, you know, and then, so then you see that, you know, the big, massive, constant fight that was involved with it. And then you read the Columbus Public Schools history, and they talk about, you know, kind of like the same year, and instead of, you know, talking about how, you know, I don't know, I mean, clearly they're not going to talk about how they resisted having a whole section of the population go to school, but, you know, they instead of talking about, you know, the struggle of James Poindexter, they're just like, you know, 70 years before the rest of the country desegregated, you know, here we were. And, you know, it's not even that they were, you know, desegregated, they were entirely separate schools, but there wouldn't have been any, you know, African-American schools at all unless this guy had made it his personal mission, you know, and then, you know, the school board, here they are, you know, 100 years later, just taking credit for, you know, it's kind of exciting.
Cool.
And what have you picked up when you talk to people? I mean, what's your approach? You just kind of walk down the street, and if somebody looks interesting, you ask them about...
A lot of the time, people talk to us first when they see us pointing a camera at their house. They usually have something to say about that.
Well, yeah. How do you decide whose house gets a camera pointed at it?
Usually, every house, I think, has been our strategy.
Yeah. I mean, are there some pretty historical houses and architecture? And
There's definitely lots of interesting architecture. One thing we did start hunting down specifically... Once we kind of started seeing this narrative of, like, this, there was this thriving, okay, so basically you had, like, a thriving economic center in this neighborhood for a long time because of forced racial segregation. All the people who weren't, you know, white WASPs were forced to live in a certain geographic space, and they couldn't get even... There was no reason for them to leave it because, you know, there was nothing but hostility outside of
it. It was a ghetto, but it wasn't a slum. I mean, it was a forced black ghetto.
But there were black rich people living inside the next to black poor people. In fact, the black rich people were employing the black poor people. You know, and then, like, you know, Jews,
middle class people working.
You know, everybody. Yeah, there were people, wealthy people living in that neighborhood and investing in that neighborhood, caring about that neighborhood. And then what happened is when the forced racial segregation stopped, what we then saw was a voluntary economic segregation. So basically everyone who could afford to leave the neighborhood got out of there, you know? I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why that's totally reasonable, you know? But they just, you know, everyone who could literally jumped the boat, and then that only left the poorest people there that, you know, couldn't afford to give each other jobs. So then you just ended up in a space where there wasn't really any economic activity. I forgot the question. I'm sorry.
No, we just, so did I, and I asked it. But part of it's reasonable, but it's really not, isn't it? Isn't it subsidized? I mean, isn't part of it is they built highways, which
allowed
developers, and
I remember,
and they cut off this neighborhood, didn't they? I mean, it isn't what used to be the black ghetto, which is now a lower class neighborhood. I mean, didn't they use the highways to really destroy it?
There was a bit of that, and there's actually some interesting stuff we got about how they actually tore down a lot of mansions, like, you know, right here where the highway is on Broad Street.
Exactly.
You know, those are actually really beautiful, glorious, huge estates, and they just plowed them all down to put up on the highway. I remembered what the question was, actually, and why we... So all these, you know, people left as soon as they could afford to. But then, so we went and we actually tracked down people who stayed. Like JP's on Main Street is a really great example of a business that has been there since like the early 60s. And, you know, Main Street has been like up and down and up and down since then. And they've been there the whole time. We went the Creole Kitchen, which is where the Marble Gang used to be. Mm-hmm. The guy who runs that had a relationship with the guy that ran the Marble Gang. They're really good friends. We have a pretty good story where he's talking about the only reason he didn't work there is because he was already working at a hotel. And he's like, you know, I'm making food for an entire hotel. Why would I want to step down to one restaurant? You know, like, that kind of a thing. But, you know, then the Marble Gang closed and he immediately moved in there and opened it up and kind of keeps that space preserved. And I think still even, like, employs some of the same people. There's still a lot of those same business relationships going on in that place. So yeah, highways, definitely everyone brings up the highways. Willis actually made a really great analogy about how it was kind of like a battleship. And so, you know, you can't really take down a battleship with one torpedo. Yeah, I mean, you can do some serious damage, but I mean, there's a reason it's a battleship, is it's supposed to be able to take a torpedo or two. But you know, but then you hit it with like three or four torpedoes, and then you punctured the hull, and now you have a sinking ship, you know. So that's kind of the highway is definitely one of those torpedoes. People who could afford to have businesses in the neighborhood leaving and then taking their businesses. And a lot of it, it's hard to say whether or not people really saw, you know, or could foresee the impact of what they were doing, or if they were just like, man, I'm so tired of running this thing. Let me just cash in now, well, you know, when I finally have an opportunity to cash in. Because, you know, I mean, as an artist, I've been there a lot of times, too, where it's like, yeah, I mean, I would love to sell out today, but no one's buying. You know? So finally, you get that buyer. You know, I mean, I can see that temptation.
Well, it sounds like there have been a lot of changes through the years in the neighborhoods, and that has even changed the way that people interact. I mean, if there are some rich people in the neighborhood employing the middle class and poor people, and then they leave, it seems like the whole community structure is changing. And
yeah, that, it did really kind of, you know, attack the stability of the neighborhood. You know, and then it created an opening for, like, you know, drugs to come in to be, you know, an alternate economy. You know, basically when you had all the stability kind of taken out, you know, most of the stability taken out, then what you have is instability. You know, I mean, it's really that clear of kind of a result. You know, and so, I mean, we've been trying to talk to people who are around at the time to kind of see, you know, if people knew what they were doing, if they cared, if they tried to do anything about it. And, you know, different, we have probably one answer from each of those categories.
Great. This is Connie Goodell Newton and Bob Fitrakis on Fight Back. We have Miles Curtis and Alex McDougal Weber in the studio with us today talking about the documentary that they're still filming, as yet unnamed, and it is on the east, it's on the Near East Side of Columbus.
I think one fun
with all
thing,
these fights about the names of the neighborhood, maybe we should call the thing As Yet Unnamed. Connie, we might have to credit.
Did you run into the African village controversy yet?
No, I think we've got guy with the art house?
Yeah, Chief Baba. Yeah, I mean, he was like, well, you know, there's an Italian village. Why can't we call this African village?
Yeah, well,
that's
a good
idea.
But then it's kind of a flip, right? Because Italian village is just as fake a name as King Lincoln is, you know, or like, oh, I guess the Short North is probably one of the few actually organic, because that's just a geographic term, you know. Right. It should have been
kind of the near east area.
Yeah,
the east area near the downtown.
Yeah.
But what about Old Town East? I mean, Old Town East, part of the notion is a lot of these mansions were boarded up for a while, and really, it's the remnants of the old hippies that were in the campus area, and the gay community and black professionals, and a little tension, I think, with the people that actually never moved out. Is there not? And now it's historical district with all sorts of regulations. Doesn't that cause tension?
There is some of that tension that we talked about a little bit today. Actually, another thing that was kind of interesting was we had a conversation about how, you know, certain parts of the neighborhood you can look at. You know, there were white lawyers, there were Jewish lawyers, there were black lawyers. You know, that all kind of swapped the neighborhood, but they were all lawyers. You know, like, you know, for all like the tension of like the, you know, everyone. And, you know, I'm sure when the white people were being replaced by black people, that, you know, they were very offended by it. But they were still lawyers replacing lawyers. You know, really, at the end of the day, there's still the kind of a similarity, like, going back to, like, this voluntary economic kind of segregation idea, just that, you know, so there's one difference that this seems kind of obvious. It might be a conflict, but, you know, really, they probably still did business with each other at the end of the day at some other point. Willis was actually talking about that, how it's kind of amazing that, that's probably because at the time, there was a depression going on, and because black people were so ostracized that they had their own economy, they had their own money, and they couldn't get a loan from white banks, so they didn't even try. You know, they had their own banks that, you know, weren't, because those banks weren't allowed to be involved in the greater economy, were actually kind of protected from the depression. So, you know, then you had white contractors who could only sell their materials to the very black people that they didn't want to talk to at all, you know. But still, there are buildings today that, like, shouldn't have been built, you know, logically, if you're thinking about, like, racial issues at the time. But, I mean, they're here, you know. So that happened. You know, and that didn't happen in Chicago or Minneapolis or a lot of other places, so, you know.
So so you're saying that there was an alternative economy that the African Americans in Columbus built themselves, and that actually carried them through the Depression.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow. That's just great. Yeah. Cool.
It's almost like the Depression was, like, delayed until, like, after, you know, everyone had the ability to go off. And, you know, they could go to get a loan from a white bank, or they could move into, like, a traditionally white neighborhood, you know. And then the only people left were people that couldn't afford to do something, you know, otherwise.
But my understanding, though, is that the area around there, Mount Vernon, King Lincoln, is, it used to be the hot club scene. There were, like, at least 36 clubs. Is that the case?
Yeah. It sure was, yeah. A lot of them disappeared with the creation of Mount Vernon Plaza.
Yeah.
That was one of the hotbeds. We've talked to a few people who are actually lamenting the loss of their favorite club from, like, the 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
But these were live music, jazz, blues club.
Yeah. Well, and now, like, Mount Vernon Plaza is basically, like, a strip mall, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, even the strip mall part was still kind of vibrant. And it's not actually, the strip mall part wasn't so bad as it was the, you know, apartment complex that literally went on top of where all these clubs that we're talking about used to be. Like, they bulldozed down that, basically the entire business corridor, and then replaced it with apartments, and then put a tiny little kind of plaza there. Which, you know, the Marble Gang was in that plaza, and that's probably why it was such a huge spot, because, you know...
What is the Marble Gang?
The Marble Gang was a jazz club that was in the Mount Vernon Plaza. It's where Creole Kitchen is today. And it was just, like, a really popular spot. And, you know, probably is in a great deal of compensation for, you know, the fact that there were 20 other clubs just a block away, you know, that are no longer are apartments today, you know.
And really, it was the who's who of the black elite in the city. I was in it many times, but I would go in there with Bill Moss, who was school board member, ran for mayor, and he'd have his own table. But at other tables would be, like, Chief Jackson, the police chief, and, you know, people that were black newscasters and VKO radio people. And it all sort of, it was the who's who of black media and black politicians.
My mom never allowed canned food in the house. The only purchased pies we would ever get would be from the Marble Gang. So,
So, Miles, one thing that you wanted to talk about today was lost skills in communities, or... tell me more about that.
Okay, so, like, one of, like, the narratives that we get, like, so much that's, like, already totally boring to us is, you know, how, like, the neighborhood used to be, like, really amazing. And it's kind of, you know, it reminds me of that Onion article where it's talking about the greatest band ever is, like, the band that's popular when you were 12. You know, like, everyone, it doesn't matter from, like, the 30s, 80s, 70s, 90s, everyone is kind of like, you know, when I was younger.
Reminiscing, like, lamenting.
The neighborhood was amazing when I was younger, you know. And, you know, if you go back to, like, the 30s through, like, even, like, up to, like, the 70s, there's, like, an entire, like, different vibe and, like, kind of, like, a legitimacy to, like, there is, like, a thing about neighborhoods that is just, like, not. And, you know, I've heard this actually, one of my friend's parents that works in D.C., I was telling him about this kind of phenomenon, you know, about just kind of, like, the loss of, like, you know, people watching out for each other and, like, knowing, you know, who each other's pets were and, like, who their schedules were. Like, you hear a lot of stories about, you know, like, kids getting in trouble, like, back in the day. And, like, you know, if you got in trouble three blocks away from your house, you know, every adult you encountered on the way back to your house would have something to say about it, you know. And then you would get back to your parents' house and have to deal with them, too, you know. There's, like, no amount of that. And he was saying, well, you know, I mean, like, the sad thing is that's everywhere. That's across planet Earth, you know. Like, we have to stop doing this. We've stopped watching out for each other. We kind of think of, you know, neighbors as kind of like a nuisance at best, most of us. You know, something that we should just, like, skip by, you know, kind of, you know.
But there's a lot of factors going on there. Number one, if you create, I mean, the United States itself is one of the few suburban Western cultures. Apparently, and this, and Connie may be able to speak to this, apparently people that live in France want to live in Paris, not in a cornfield outside of Paris. And people in London want to live in the city. Uh-huh. But in the United States, I mean, people find a cornfield in Pataskala or Pickerington, and they're going, that is so me. And there's like four models, like one's the diplomat. And it goes back to the 50s, right? Levittown, my favorite model at Levittown, the country clubber. Well, but it's you take these beautiful buildings and this architect and this history, and instead you move out where you don't know anyone, and now you've got air conditioning and a privacy fence, and they're not built for walking. I mean, there's not even sidewalks in these areas, and then it's like, well, nobody knows anyone. Well, yeah, of course. Right, you didn't build it for any interaction.
I think
like these cities were built.
I think a lot of the difference really has to do with our mode of transportation. You know, the road, the highway, the car has made some of those areas accessible. And you know, we've white people have come to the United States and settled it very quickly. In Europe, they have been, you know, living in the same place for a couple thousand more years and building their civilization slowly. So they had to build their civilization without automobiles. I think that you'll find they're less isolated there from each other.
So what you're saying is like they need to bulldoze those old buildings?
Well, like, even, I would say, even, like, the way streets are set up, we actually had a pretty good conversation about how Long Street, you know, for a long time was just, you know, if you think of 4th and Summit, they're still kind of like this, you know, it's like the Clintonville International Highway. They're just designed to get you from one end of Long Street, you know, from Wilson to the other side of Parsons. And, you know, simply just adding a parking lane and, you know, turn lanes and, like, calming the traffic down so that it wasn't about just getting from one end of the street to the other end of the street, but it was actually about, you know, like, stopping in the middle of the street and maybe
there's actually something in between.
It's not just like buzz through kind of region. Which is kind of, you know, that's the other side of the freeways. You know, like, first, okay, so they build the freeways, which make it so that, you know, you're not unintentionally going through this area anymore. Like, it used to be, like, all the streets were kind of interconnected, and if you wanted to get from one place to another, you'd have to go through, you know. And, I mean, of course, you know, the people designed around this so that they didn't have to go through the parts of town they didn't want to go through or whatever. But, you know, I mean, it was easier to unintentionally go somewhere. As where with the freeways, you know, you're just zipping past everywhere, and like anything that's between your two exits is just not even like a thought to you, right? And then where people do have to go through the area, they've just made it little mini freeways, so that even though you're in it, you know, you're not, you know, it's like a flyover part of town that you're just buzzing through, even if you are going inside of it. You know?
Yeah, that was Michael Harrington's great revelation in The Other America. That the poor become invisible because the highways are set down on the ground, so you're seeing a few rooftops. And when I was in Detroit, you know, when you get flash floods, the highways would become like little rivers, and you'd see people come up to the surface streets, and they were like terrified. It's like they didn't even know how to get to the suburbs. It's like, you know, it's okay, you're going east, crash it. You're going north, that'd be Woodward. And they would be scared, just petrified. And I try to help them out, say, like, you just go to the corner at Bethune where the dwarf works. That's your corner.
And they're like, is it safe to stop at the stop signs and stoplights, or should I just run them all?
But don't we have that with Willie Main Street? Yeah. I mean, isn't there...
670 especially. 670 and 71. Yeah, you can ride down 670 now, and you can't even see the neighborhoods that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it's real fast to get from my place into work on 670, but when I take the side streets, I really see so much more of the neighborhood.
But what about Main Street,
the
former National Highway? Have you done any interviews over there?
Yeah. Well, Main Street's where JP's is, so we were over there talking to the owner of JP's.
Did you talk to Tony?
No, we didn't get to talk to Tony. Maybe not very good health. But Main Street was actually made the national highway instead of Broad Street because folks on Broad Street didn't want that traffic going through those nice boulevards with their oak trees and everything.
Yeah,
so they shot people over to Main Street where they could have where the Main Street wanted the business anyway, and just had them jog around and come back to Broad Street later.
Yeah, and that's a conversation we had earlier too about how so you had you know like the Black Enclave a little bit north on Long Street and Mount Vernon, so that was a business center, and then Broad Street we have some really amazing pictures of Broad Street in the last century or the century before the last whatever. And I mean, it's just all these like luscious trees. It kind of looks like I'm thinking of Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow. If you can think of like some of the scenes in that, where it's just like really broad street, just lined with trees. There's some interesting stories about actually, with the advent of cars. Maybe the exhaust was giving the trees diseases. So the trees came down. Because they were actually kind of dying on the cars. Sounds like what was happening. But, it was really beautiful. And so, of course, they didn't want businesses on the street because it was there to be gorgeous.
There were three streets in the center. Yeah. Broad Street was three streets. There was one street in the middle, two rows of oak trees, and then two more streets on either side. So the people going up Broad Street actually had, like, three different, like...
Was it different lanes because it was just at the beginning of the automobile, so they still had horse and carriage, and they also had automobiles simultaneously?
Like pre-automobiles. Yeah, so I think it's horse and carriages. And a lot of it was just, I think, just to get the effect of, being under these really gorgeous... Like, it was... I'm trying to describe it. It's like literally like a canopy. Yeah. So,
trees. You really describe it to people who haven't seen trees on Broad Street before? It's pretty... Two quick questions to finish up.
Part of it, we're in the back of the Hannah house, but supposedly from where we are here in the alley all the way over to Madison was nothing but trees, too. So people had their own individual sort of Victorian gardens. So not only was Broad Street lush, is that everyone had these huge backyards instead
before they put in all the parking lots.
Yeah.
Well, two quick questions to finish up.
They really did pay paradise.
First, you've looked at a lot of historical, pictures and talked to people about the neighborhood going back decades. And I guess I would just ask you, what are your recommendations given all this history for how we can move forward in communities? And then. Finally, before we wrap up, I'd also like to ask you, if you have a website or when your documentary might be coming out so people can view it. But first, any recommendations for moving forward in the future or predictions?
Well, in my mind, what people talk about most eagerly is just that, community. And what we're hoping to do with the film eventually is to have an idea of how community can be something that is built, and I'm using quotations on every one of these words right now, how it's something that can be built for people to be a part of. So how we can have development on the east side without ruining the time that the people who are on the east side are having, and how to build something like community on the east side for the people living on the east side.
Yeah, and hopefully break it down into like actual behaviors, because a lot of times when you talk about these kind of issues, it's really easy to get stuck in kind of these like giant amorphous abstract concepts. And so we kind of like to break it down, community is made from, one, talking to each other, two, sharing, and kind of just go kind of down that way. Hopefully it won't be that Dick and Jane, but kind of break it down to things you can actually, I can talk to people, I know what sharing is, those kind of things. So you actually have behaviors that you can take home and show to your kids and that kind of stuff. And do with each other. I got a little note here that says I should mention that we were sponsored partially with a grant that came through the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism. I think the money was originally from the Columbus Foundation. So that has been a total help. In terms of a website and stuff, I do want to have... There's a great service called Voto, which is a legal BitTorrenting site. It's kind of, similar to... everyone knows, like, Pirate Bay or something like that. Except the difference is Pirate Bay is typically people putting up things that other people have made without their permission. And Voto is all people who have made the movies themselves, putting up the movies, funding them through the site, building kind of an organic fan base that way. And so I'm really excited about getting a Voto page made, which will probably come shortly after we get a name for it, because then I can get domains and stuff with the name. And actually, we had talked about if any of the listeners, anyone from the Near East Side, wants to come in and contribute a name. We're totally into that. So far, I think we have like Welcome No Loitering. We talked earlier about just, you know, all the different. We could just have a hodgepodge of every name of the neighborhood. So the Blackberry,
and I call
King
it
Lincoln.
Compton, because so yeah. Columbus needs a Compton, so we can have better rap.
I thought there's a Compton Street somewhere. There's a Punta. So. Well, would it be the Bronze, Blackberry, Poindexter, King Lincoln Village?
It's going to be a 90-minute music video.
Near East. Yeah. Have you seen the Dark Crystal, that Robot Chicken, Dark Crystal parody? It's going to be like that.
All right. So look forward. Catches the yet untitled documentary.
All right. Thank you so much for being our guests. We have Miles Curtis and Alex McDougall Weber in the studio talking about their upcoming documentary, and this is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on 98.3 102.1,
and we think it's so groovy now that people are finally getting together.
Yeah. Oh.